Okay, let's talk about Friedrich Nietzsche. We've so far looked at a whole bunch of different ethical approaches. We've seen deontology and consequentialism and virtue ethics and social contract approach, a couple of different versions of that. We've looked at more contemporary views as well. But we're getting into a couple of topics here at the end calling them ethical systems or ethical principles isn't quite accurate, but I think a discussion of them is useful and interesting, and certainly provides a little bit of insight into some of the things, some of the movements, some of the ideas that have happened a little bit more recently. Nietzsche is a figure that you've probably heard of. If people know the names of philosophers outside of the big ones like Aristotle and Plato and so on, Nietzsche isn't too far down that list of recognizable names. He's a pretty well-known figure, and he's quite controversial. He's oftentimes used in film, TV, movies, things like that, as a device. If your movie or TV show has a character who is sort of like an intelligent outcast, somebody who's misunderstood, but smart, and kind of anti-establishment or kind of against the common beliefs of the time, oftentimes they are shown reading Nietzsche or talking about Nietzsche, or, you know, there's a picture of Nietzsche on the wall or something like that. It's a common device that's used to invoke Nietzsche to show that a character is sort of an intelligent outcast, misunderstood. So our goal is to maybe understand a little bit better about what Nietzsche is getting at. Now, we're looking at late 19th century. Nietzsche died in the year 1900, and he spent the last little more than a decade of his life quite literally insane from syphilis. Syphilis, as you might know, is a disease that, well, for lack of a better way of saying it, it kind of turns your brain, over enough time, it kind of turns your brain to mush. And he was quite literally insane in the last years of his life. And his sister was sort of put in charge of his writings and his estate. Now, what happened later, obviously he died in 1900, so he wasn't around for what came in the next few decades. But his sister was around for a while and saw some of the rise of German nationalism and used her brother's writings to support or justify some of the actions and policies that were starting to form. So sometimes Nietzsche is kind of known as the Nazi philosopher. And that reputation is, well, it's not entirely undeserved, but it is largely due to, again, misunderstanding. Because Nietzsche's sister did kind of cherry-pick particular passages taken out of context and so on to specifically support her beliefs and her views. Nietzsche himself, of course, was unaware of all of this stuff because he had been dead for a long time at this point. But he does definitely have some controversial views. And he's also quite different than many of the other folks that we've discussed. There's not really a lot of argument. There's not a whole lot of philosophical rigor in what he's writing. If you look at the excerpt I've given you, his writing is deliberately emotional. he is speaking in a voice, in a written voice here that is full of bombast and anger and vitriol. And he is clearly trying to evoke emotions. And he's talking in a way that we're speaking and writing in a way that we're probably not used to from the things that we've read so far. Now, what Nietzsche is trying to do is he's trying to understand and make claims about not really an ethical, large objective ethical theory. He's trying to make claims about human nature and development and where we are, or at least should be going. He's concerned about our path, our current path, as a species. And he wants to kind of reset things and put us on what he sees to be the more proper path, the more beneficial path, the more natural path. So let's take a look at what exactly he's saying here in this excerpt that I've given you now. By the way, this particular excerpt is taken from one of Nietzsche's works called Beyond Good and Evil. And if you are getting more into, or do want to get more into, the readings of Nietzsche, I do suggest that as a place to start. The more well-known, the more famous is probably Thus Spake the Zarathustra. That's the one that is more often seen. But I would suggest Beyond Good and Evil as a better starting point to understand exactly what he's getting at. And indeed, even the title tells you some of the direction that he's going in. Beyond good and evil. We're not talking about good and evil. We're talking about something beyond that. So, okay. At the beginning here, let's try to understand what Nietzsche is doing and saying. As usual, you can pause the audio when I ask a question and see if you can figure these things out for yourself. So right at the beginning of the excerpt here, he says, "Every elevation of the type man has hitherto been the work of an aristocratic society, and so it will always be. A society believing in a long scale of gradations of rank and differences of worth among human beings and requiring slavery in some form or other. Without the pathos of distance, such as grows out of the incarnated difference of classes, out of the constant outlooking and downlooking of the ruling caste on subordinates and instruments, and out of their equally constant practice of obeying and commanding, of keeping down and keeping at a distance, that other more mysterious pathos could never have arisen. The longing for an ever new widening of distance within the soul itself, the formation of ever higher, rarer, further, more extended, more comprehensive states, in short, just the elevation of the type man, the continued self-surmounting of man, to use a moral formula in a super-moral sense. To be sure, one must not resign oneself to any humanitarian illusions about the history of the origin of an aristocratic society. The truth is hard. Let us acknowledge unprejudicedly how every higher civilization has hitherto originated. Men with a still natural nature, barbarians in every terrible sense of the word, men of prey still in possession of unbroken strength of will and desire for power, threw themselves upon weaker, more moral, more peaceful races, or upon old, mellow civilizations in which the final vital force was flickering out in brilliant fireworks of wit and depravity. At the commencement, the noble caste was always the barbarian caste. Their superiority did not consist, first of all, in their physical, but in their psychical power. They were more complete men, which at every point also implies the same as more complete beasts." Now, There's a lot going on in that paragraph, and my goodness, is he making some heavy claims there. He's saying some things that might sound, well, quite against the way that we've kind of been brought up to think. So take a minute and try to understand what exactly you think he's getting at in this paragraph. What does he mean by elevation of the type man? What does he mean by more complete beasts? What does he mean by this super moral sense? What does he mean by these humanitarian illusions? Just take a minute and think about what the claims being made here are. So, every elevation of the type man, he's talking about the species, the human species being elevated or growing or developing. And he's saying these developments, the progress that humans have made, the progress that we as a species have made, has been due to an aristocratic society, and so it will always be. An aristocratic society. Now, we've discussed this a bit already, but aristocratic society here means that there are different groups, different classes of people, and each group or class of people has their own job to perform. And the true meaning of the word aristocratic or aristocracy is rule by the best. Now, he's saying here that this society that has this scale of gradations of rank, that there are differences of worth among human beings, even requiring slavery in some form or another, this is necessary. This is essential to the elevation, growth, development of humanity. Without this difference of rank and worth, we don't have development. We don't have growth. This kind of view is saying essentially, look, we have to recognize that there are reasons why certain advancements have happened. Advancements as a species have happened in the past because of these differences of rank, these differences of worth, and they have been pushed forward by those in power. If we are to think of ourselves as equal, if we're to think of ourselves as not having these gradations of rank and worth, then these elevations, these advancements, don't happen. How has higher civilization originated? It's happened not because we're all kumbaya, lovey-dovey with each other, helping each other out all the time. It's happened. Higher civilizations have happened, they have originated, and they have advanced because those with their still natural nature, those who are barbarians, those who have this desire for power, those who throw themselves upon the weak, those who take that power, those who exercise their superiority, have pushed the societies forward in advancement. Notice he says that those who are weaker and more peaceful are also the ones that are more moral. Remember, we're going beyond good and evil here. So if we're thinking about how these things, these advancements have happened, it's because of these barbarians. It's because we've had people of strong will, barbarians who are men of prey, who have exercised that will and that power to get their will done. We can think of a few examples. Go back to ancient Egypt. Some of the most amazing feats of science and engineering and mathematics have happened in ancient Egypt to create things like the Great Pyramid. That was a massive undertaking that required lots of advancement in mathematics and engineering and all sorts of things just to get that pyramid made. Now, why was that pyramid made? Well, because Pharaoh wanted a pyramid. If you didn't have Pharaoh requiring that we lesser humans build the pyramid for him, would the pyramid have been built? Well, no. And if the pyramid didn't have to be built, would the advancements in math and science and engineering and all the rest have happened? No. And without those advancements in math and science and engineering and all the rest, would the benefits to the rest of us have trickled down to us from the advancements made to build the pyramid? Well, no. What sort of motivation do we normal, regular people have if we're just all kind of equal? Pharaoh wants a pyramid. We got to build him a pyramid. We can think of all sorts of other examples. The Roman aqueducts are another great example. Why did we have to build the Roman aqueducts? Well, because Caesar wants clean, fresh water coming into the palace. Again, massive advancements in engineering and material science and all the rest to get that done. If we didn't have the strong-willed and powerful Caesar requiring such a thing to be done, would we have done it? No. Once it is done, for the sake of Caesar, look what happens now. We all get to benefit. Now, we get the runoff from the palace, and we get to have fresh water and public fountains in the middle of the city. It's better for everyone. This sort of advancement is done because we have this draw. We have this desire for power among these upper class, and they drive things and move things forward. Now, we have to recognize the next point that Nietzsche says. We have to recognize in a good and healthy aristocracy that it should not regard itself as a function either of the kingship or the commonwealth, but as the significance and highest justification thereof. That it should therefore accept with a good conscience the sacrifice of a legion of individuals who, for its sake, must be suppressed and reduced to imperfect men, to slaves and instruments. Its fundamental belief must be precisely that society is not allowed to exist for its own sake, but only as a foundation and scaffolding by means of which a select class of beings may be able to elevate themselves to their higher duties, and in general to a higher existence. Now, look at that. We are kind of brought up to believe that the upper class, those in power, government, whatever you want to call it, exists to serve us, the people. That's got it the wrong way around, according to Nietzsche. No. Really, the point of a society is to lift up and elevate the select class of these higher beings, the superior humans. We exist for their sake, as their foundation, and he says scaffolding. We're a means by which the select caste of beings can elevate themselves. The people exist for the sake of Caesar. Caesar doesn't exist for the sake of the people. That's the basic idea. Now, again, that's different than we're commonly thought, we commonly are raised to believe. But this is indeed what Nietzsche is saying. There are these naturally superior folks, right? And these naturally superior folks gather power, have strong will, push things forward, and essentially use the rest of us as a means to complete their projects. To refrain mutually from injury, from violence, from exploitation, and put one's will on a par with that of others. This may result in a certain rough sense in good conduct among individuals when the necessary conditions are given. As soon, however, as one wished to take this principle more generally, and if possible, even as the fundamental principle of society, it would immediately disclose what it really is: a will to the denial of life, a principle of dissolution and decay. Now, this whole idea here is saying, look, if we're going to go care about others, right? If we're going to act in this moral sense where we care about all these other people, if we're going to do this objective morality thing, this actually is a principle of dissolution and decay. It is the will to the denial of life. It's the denial of what makes us human. What Nietzsche is saying basically here is we, naturally as humans, have what he calls this will to power. We're all selfish. We all want power. The problem, now, power, of course, takes all sorts of forms. I mean, you can have power in terms of political or military power or economic power or whatever. Power takes all sorts of forms, but all of us want power. That's his claim, one of his claims. All of us basically have this natural desire, this natural will to power. Now, being unequal, of course, not all of us are going to be able to actually achieve this. We're not all actually going to be able to gain it, to bring that power to ourselves. But what we do in putting forth some objective morality is essentially deny, or trying to deny, that we have that will to power in the first place. It's almost like we use morality as an excuse for our failures. We all want power. Most of us don't have the ability to get it. We're too weak, we're not strong-willed enough, we're not skilled enough, we're not intelligent enough, whatever it is. Most of us are not going to actually get it. So what we do instead is we say, no, we don't really want it in the first place, because we're being moral. We're being ethical. But that amounts, that sort of principle, if we use it, as he says, as this fundamental principle of our society, then that amounts to a denial of what makes us human. It's a denial of life. Because naturally we are this kind of being that is selfish and desires power. So, what's the problem then? Well, the problem is that we have this, as he says, sentimental weakness, right? We have this kind of decay festering in society that results in a big danger, a big threat to the further advancement of our species. One must think profoundly to the very basis and resist all sentimental weakness. Life itself is essentially appropriation, injury, conquest of the strange and weak, suppression, severity, obtrusion of peculiar forms, incorporation, and at the least, putting it mildest, exploitation. Life is exploitation. But why should one forever use precisely these words on which for ages a disparaging purpose has been stamped? Exploitation has negative connotations. Even the organization within which As was previously supposed, the individuals treat each other as equal. It takes place in every healthy aristocracy. Must itself, if it be a living and not a dying organization, do all that towards other bodies, which the individuals within it refrain from doing to each other? It will have to be the incarnated will to power. So, we have an issue. We have a problem in society. It is eating away at our growth and development and advancement. And that problem is this denial of our natural will to power. It's a denial of the fundamental fact that we're different, that some are worth more than others. Some are actually better than others. So, what's the origin of this? How is it spreading? How do we stop this spread? What needs to be done? What is Nietzsche's answer to this conundrum? What do you think of the conundrum in the first place? Do you think he's right? Well, obviously goes very counter, very against the way that we've been raised and brought up to think. It's clearly controversial, and you can see why, I think. He has been associated with some not-so-savory folks throughout 20th century history.